water and sunlight, the two most important resources of the moon. Water for life, sunlight for electrical power. Bernard is right, Doug told himself. That's the most valuable real estate on the moon down there. He felt the excitement building in him all over again. In the Lobber's cockpit, Bernard was scanning the readouts on his panel displays. What are the others doing? He asked Killifer.
Right on track, following us like nice little puppies.
Superb. Bernard's gloved fingers flicked along the control panel.
Okay, we're going in.
The Lobber tilted back to its original vertical orientation. Killifer punched up the camera view of the ground on the main display screen.
Awful dark down there, he muttered.
Infrared, Bernard snapped. The image on the display screen did not change much. Still dark, with vague suggestions of shapes looming in the shadows.
Braking in 10 seconds, Killifer read from the flight plan display.
I know.
Altitude 20.
I know.
Killifer realized that Bernard was jumpy. They both peered hard at the camera display.
Lights, Bernard ordered.
Too high to do much good, Killifer muttered, but he turned on the powerful lamps that had been installed on the underside of the Lobber's main platform.
Bernard's gloved thumb hovered over the keypad that would override the rocket's firing.
The shadowy ground was rushing up toward them. Killifer could see a jumble of shapes glittering in the reflected light of the landing lamps.
Boulders, he yelped. Big ones!
Smoothly, Bernard ignited the main rocket thrusters. Killifer felt a sudden surge of weight, but before he could even take a breath, it disappeared and they were falling again.
Goldman! Bernard called into his helmet microphone.
Jump the boulder field. Follow me.
Following, came Goldman's voice in their earphones, professionally unperturbed.
Reset the braking program, Bernard commanded.
Killifer tapped the keyboard.
Reset.
The camera view showed a smoother stretch of ground beneath them. A great deal of rocks were still strewn across the area, but they were smaller, less dangerous. The hard, stony ground rushed up at them, stopped momentarily, then came at them again. The image on the display screen blurred.
Rocket exhaust, Killifer knew.
Then he felt a thump, and the familiar sensation of weight returned.
We're down, he said to Bernard, and realized he was sweating inside his suit.
Number two, Bernard called into his helmet mic.
120.
70.
Touchdown.
We're about 50 meters off your left rear. About 7 o'clock in relation to your cockpit.
Both men turned in their seats but could not see the second spacecraft from their position.
The drones, Bernard said. The two unmanned vehicles were programmed to follow Bernard's craft at a preset distance and to land 100 meters on either side of it.
Killifer glanced at the radar display.
Coming in now, he said, pointing to the blips their beacons made.
He could see one of the robot craft descending, its braking rockets winking on and off against the dark shadows of the mountains.
Override, Bernard snapped. It's coming down in the boulder field.
But it was too late. The unmanned Lobber touched one of its outstretched legs on a boulder almost as big as the vehicle itself. The other three landing pads were still a good 10 meters above the ground. The attitude control thrusters tried to keep the vehicle from tipping over for several wobbling, twitching seconds, but they gave out, and the spacecraft tilted, and finally struck the ground with a soundless crash. Killifer saw the landing legs crumple and the cargo pods split open. An oxygen tank blew apart in a silent burst of frost-glittering chunks. From the passenger module, Doug saw the crash. His first reaction was, "My God, that could have been us." Then he wondered how much equipment they had lost.
"Well, we're down safely, at least," he said to the others in the bubble.
They muttered replies, voices hushed, subdued.
"I think my telescope was in the pod that broke open," Bianca said worriedly. "I'll have to go over and see if it survived the crash."
By the time the six of them unstrapped from their seats and wormed through the hatch to stand on the ground, Bernard was already striding toward the crashed craft. Everybody's spacesuit was basically white, although some of them had been used so hard they were gray with embedded lunar dust. But Bernard was easy to spot, even in a suit. His was sparkling new, gleaming white,
and had red stripes down the arms and legs. For recognition, he had said. Doug followed Brennard and his second-in-command, Killifer. He caught up with them as they reached the edge of the wreckage. It was impossible to see their faces behind their heavily tinted visors, but Brennard clearly radiated disgust, fists clenched on his hips. "See whose equipment's on this ship and get them to check out this mess," Brennard commanded. "Determine if any of it's still usable." "Right," said Killifer. "Is there anything I can do to help?" Doug asked. Brennard wheeled and leaned down slightly to read the name tag printed on the breast of Doug's suit. "Oh, Doug, I suppose you're going to remind me that you wanted to land further out, aren't you?" Surprised at the sarcasm in the older man's voice, Doug said, "No, sir, it hadn't entered my mind." "No," Brennard said, "of course not." "Were any of our life support supplies on this ship?" Doug asked. Brennard huffed. "Of course there were. The only question is how much of it have we lost. Jack, check it out."
"Right," said Killifer.
"What can I do to help?" Doug asked again.
"Just keep out of the way," Brennard snapped. "Like the man said, leave the real work to the professionals."
Then he started walking back toward the first spacecraft, leaving Doug puzzled and feeling more than a little hurt. The base that Yamagata Industries established at the beautiful and prominent crater Copernicus on the Sea of Rains was called Nippon One. Admittedly, this was an unimaginative name of no intrinsic grace and would be changed to something more poetic in time. For now, however, its utilitarian nature mirrored the character of the base itself. Nippon One was small, crowded, and unlovely. Little more than a collection of huts buried beneath protective regolith rubble, much as Moonbase had been nearly 20 years earlier. The worst part of serving at Nippon One was the lack of water for bathing. Even with nanomachines to ferret out atoms of hydrogen embedded in the regolith and combine them with lunar oxygen, water was scarce and precious. Yamagata engineers had developed an ultrasonic device which, they claimed, cleaned the skin more efficiently than detergent and water. Nippon One's inhabitants complained that its ultrasonic vibrations gave them headaches, its vacuum suction sometimes plucked hair painfully from one's body, and it did nothing to relieve the body odors that made lunar living so unpleasant. Still, it was a great honor to be assigned to serve at Nippon One, even if only for a few months. Yamagata's brightest young men and women eagerly sought lunar postings. This new frontier was the key to rapid advancement up the corporate ladder. Miyoko Homma was the daughter of an old and honored Japanese family. Trained in astronomy and mathematics, she was determined to prove to her elders that a woman can add luster to the family name, just as a man can. She had jumped at the chance to work at Nippon One. That was 4 months ago. Now, sitting in a cramped cubicle, feeling sweaty and filthy in fatigues that she had been wearing for several days on end, all she truly wished for was a steaming hot bath and just a bit of privacy. She was checking the telescopes sitting up on the surface of Mare Imbrium, a chore she did daily, patiently studying the images they showed on her display screen as she ran each instrument through its checkout procedures to make certain that it was operating within its designated parameters. Her mind was wandering, though, to thoughts of home and comforts that she would not know for another 2 months. Sitting next to her, close enough to touch shoulders, was Toshihara Yamashita, one of the communications technicians, headphone clamped to his ear. "Have you heard the news?" Toshi asked. "The Americans have sent an expedition to the South Pole." That jolted Miyoko out of her reverie.
"No," she said.
"It's true. The chiefs are trying to decide if we should put up a reconnaissance satellite to watch them."
"But we're sending a team to the pole, aren't we? I've heard about the preparations for weeks now."
"The Yanks have beaten us to it," said Toshi. "Somebody's head will roll."
"Have they gone to the Bright Mountain?" Miyoko asked.
"Where else?"
"Ah, that's too bad. Now they'll set up a base there, won't they?"
"Of course. That's what we wanted to do."
"And there's water ice there, too," Miyoko murmured. "Now the Americans will claim it all."
Toshi leaned back in his spindly chair, shrugging. "If the ice fields are big enough, we can send a crew out there and stake our own claim. Maybe there's enough for more than one.
Miyoko felt doubtful,